From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the earthquake in Haiti, the presidential election in Ukraine, and the crows of Tokyo. International aid has begun to arrive in Haiti as the world tries to help Haitians recover from the devastating earthquake there. In the hours immediately after the quake hit, the priority was rescuing those trapped under the rubble and helping people injured in the disaster. NPR's Jason Beaubien was one of the first reporters to reach the capital, Port-au-Prince. And he spoke to NPR's Melissa Bloch.
Right now I'm outside the Villa Creole Hotel, which is in the Pétionville neighborhood, an elite neighborhood of Port-au-Prince. And it's really quite amazing. People have brought their injured children out front here because they know that there are Western medical doctors staying inside. So people have come here to try to get attention mainly for their children. There's a girl, there's a girl right in front of me at the moment. She's covered in bandages. She's laying on just they're from the deck chairs that would be by the pool. She's naked except for what looks like a tablecloth on top of her, and she keeps lifting her head, and her lips are shaking. Sorry, Melissa.
That's okay.
It's heartbreaking what's happening here. There are people just in the streets everywhere. When you drive through, there are tent cities that have been sort of set up just in little lots. People are clearly just living wherever they can.
Jason, the girl you just described, is she getting any medical attention there?
She clearly has gotten some medical attention because there are fresh bandages on her, and there are other people who are getting medical attention, but the numbers are just so huge that there are people who are waiting for attention. There's clearly the expectation that there are people who are still trapped in some of these buildings.
Does the girl have any family there with her, do you know?
I assume that she has family here, but it's really quite striking. She's lying out in what would just normally be the driveway, and there's no one around her.
Hmm. Jason, you came into Haiti overland by car from the Dominican Republic. Can you describe that journey, what you saw as you crossed the border and made your way into Haiti?
What is really striking is the drive-in just shows how distant the Dominican Republic is from Haiti. These are countries that are not incredibly linked. The border, the road going to the border is terrible. At times it turns into just a rutted dirt road. This is the main road linking Port-au-Prince to Santiago in the Dominican Republic. There is no activity really going on there at all. There's no aid trucks. You weren't seeing refugees. You weren't seeing anything really going on out there. There was pretty much nothing. At the border, there were some people trying to get across. There were some people that were coming across in ambulances to a hospital that is right there on the border, but it was only about 100 people, the Red Cross told me, had come over the last 24 hours, which by the scale of this is a fairly small number.
So somehow they had managed to make their way all the way to the border with the Dominican Republic to get medical help.
It's true, and to some degree that's an indication of just how desperate people are to get out of the capital, which is just in shambles, really. You start to see it about 20 miles out from the capital. You start to see a few buildings that have knocked down, and then it gets more and more intense the closer you get to the center of the city. It's almost as if the epicenter was not right underneath Port-au-Prince, but that's how it feels when you drive in. You can just see it get more and more destruction, more buildings that have fallen in, more chaos the closer you get to the heart of Port-au-Prince.
NPR's Jason Beaubien talking there to Melissa Bloch on All Things Considered. To Ukraine now, and back in the winter of 2004, thousands of people, mostly young students, took to the streets of the Ukrainian capital Kiev. They overturned a tainted election, and they hoped for a new democratic Ukraine. Now, 5 years later, another election, this time with 18 candidates standing for president. And those dreams and hopes of all those protesters? Well, it seems they've been lost in political infighting and economic decline. Here's NPR's David Green from Kiev.
The sounds from those cold nights in Kiev's Independence Square still seem to echo through the streets. The man who symbolized the revolution for Westerners was Viktor Yushchenko, his face left green and pockmarked by a mysterious poisoning. He became president. But that's the voice people here remember, his ally, Yulia Tymoshenko. She stole the show. Join us in the streets, she told the crowd, until a fair election is held.
Were you standing there in the square back in 2004 when Tymoshenko was up there talking? And
Yes. I saw her. I saw them all. It was exciting.
That's a voice from today. 24-year-old Svetlana Osipchuk was in Kiev this week at the university where she gathered with other students 5 years ago. Here's how she's feeling as the new election looms.
The unity of 2004 is broken now.
That unity broke quickly. After taking office, President Yushchenko made Tymoshenko prime minister, but the two soon became rivals, and today many of their ardent supporters see the economy's in bad shape, politics remain corrupt, and that revolutionary spirit seems gone. They blame Yushchenko and Tymoshenko. Although both of them are candidates in Sunday's vote, Svetlana, for her part, says she won't vote for either of them. Still, she looks back to 2004 with no regret.
This aim was good. This aim was positive. This aim was the declaration of something new for our country because it gave us a great democratic experience and we could repeat it. And they know that we could repeat it.
Mixed emotions are easy to find in Kiev these days. Nizar Pervak is an attorney. The 27-year-old was also a student in 2004. And he recalls stuffing wads of newspaper beneath his T-shirt because he feared the army would start firing rubber bullets. His bravery, though, has turned to embarrassment now. He says the leaders he brought to power have shown their greatest skill is bickering. But if he has lost faith in politics, he points to changes in Ukraine that he does like.
Before 2004, people, especially those working in state institutions, were afraid to show their political and social views in public. Now it has changed. The people are more open and not afraid.
Nizar said he's not worried, even if the upcoming election turns back the Orange Revolution. The candidate leading in some polls is Viktor Yanukovych, the target of the Orange Revolution. He was the winner of that rigged election back in 2004. He still has significant backing in eastern Ukraine and a realistic chance to stage a comeback and turn the results of that popular revolt upside down. That would be tough to swallow for another person on Kiev's Independence Square, Maria Mashkovska.
This is one of the biggest monument and the central monument which we have seen during the Orange Revolution.
She pointed out exactly where she stood in 2004. Like so many veterans of the Orange Revolution, she's been frustrated by all the political infighting. But maybe, she says, politicians in her country have learned some lessons.
Because I'm Ukrainian, I always will be thinking that there is a chance.
Even though she says the Orange Revolution has, in her words, come to nothing, she said she'd never discourage young people from taking to the streets when they think it's right.
To fight, to get freedom is very important for people. If the question will be to come or not to come, I'll come. I'll not stay home.
Despite their misgivings, all three veterans of the revolution expect to vote in Ukraine's presidential election. But none of them say they're happy about the choices they'll have to make. David Green, NPR News, Kiev.
Coming up, how Tokyo is dealing with its malevolent crows.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. For the last 8 years, the city of Tokyo has been waging war on crows. The campaign reportedly began after a crow buzzed the city's governor as he was playing golf. The governor immediately announced that he'd turn crow meat pie into Tokyo's favourite dish. Fortunately for the crows, that idea didn't catch on. But the battle with the pesky passerines continues today, as NPR's Louisa Lim found out on a recent trip to Tokyo.
This is the sound that makes Yumiko Kono's heart beat faster as she pounds around Yoyogi Park in central Tokyo. She's a long-distance runner who covers at least 7 miles a day. She's highly sensitive to sound since she's blind. She runs with the aid of a companion. A year and a half ago, she was attacked by a crow in the park, an experience that has traumatized her.
A crow landed on my head just for an instant while I was running. It was like it was using my head as a jumping board. I was surprised, then scared. Now when I hear crows cawing and their wings flapping, I still get scared.
She's not alone. Many Tokyo dwellers have been dive-bombed by the big black jungle crows that flap around the city. Everyone knows someone who's been pecked or pooped upon. For Alfred Hitchcock fans, it's eerily reminiscent of his thriller, The Birds.
I mean, birds just don't go around attacking people without no reason, you know what I mean? Kids probably scared them, that's all.
These birds attacked.
In that movie, flocks of birds victimised one small town, with hundreds of crows attacking the local schoolchildren. In Tokyo, it's not that bad yet. But the big black bullies do cause technological havoc. They nest in utility poles and cause blackouts. They even steal fibre-optic cables to build nests, sometimes disabling parts of the broadband network. Tokyo's crow czar, Toshimasa Uno, admits crow numbers are on the up. He blames commuter crows, who fly in to feast on the capital's garbage.
The crow number increased by 16% from the year before. We think the reason is that crows fly into Tokyo from the suburbs.
He says the corvine population now stands, or flies, at an estimated 21,200. That's despite millions of dollars spent on the war on crows.
The crow budget for 2009 was about $700,000. The year before, it worked out to around $50 for every crow killed. But we have to spend this money because people are complaining.
We're here with park manager Koji Takagi, and we're picking our way amongst the greenery, and we're going to see the crow traps the government's been using to try to battle the crows.
Most of the crows we catch with this trap are young ones that are inexperienced. But it's good to catch the young ones so they can't breed and increase the number of crows.
Back in Yoyogi Park, birds are thrashing around inside the traps, which are enormous cages 10 by 20 feet, open in the middle. The crows are lured in by lard smeared on the ground. Once in, hanging spikes stop them from flying out. Park manager Takagi says every 3 days, the trapped crows are taken away to be gassed.
We do get complaints from people opposed to the crow extermination, but this is the policy of the Environment Bureau. People should also learn to deal with garbage better.
So we're now going to see a very unusual project here in central Tokyo, in the swanky shopping district of Ginza. That buzzing noise that you can probably hear is 300,000 honeybees that are being kept in beehives right in the center of Tokyo. And Atsuo Tanaka, the co-founder of the Ginza Honeybee Project, says this project is actually helping keep the crows away.
The bees become very aggressive when they see shiny black objects because it reminds them of bears or hornets that might attack them. So whenever they see crows, a whole swarm of bees will chase them.
And although the honeybees chase away the black marauders, they're surprisingly friendly to humans.
You try it?
You want me to touch those honeybees? Yes, yes. Will they bite me?
Yes, okay. No.
Okay, I'm very nervous. I'm actually touching the back of the honeybees. They are. It's really soft.
This may be an eco-friendly solution, and one which provides honey into the bargain. But so far, it's unproven and impractical on a larger scale. The battle of birds and bees seems almost surprising in the setting of Tokyo's high-tech urban jungle. But the war on crows underlines that finding the right balance between man and nature isn't easy, even in a city. Louisa Lim, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.